here with RP Eddie as always, RP Daily. Welcome, RP. I want to welcome Jocelyn Mangan. Jocelyn, I've seen you in action. It's always nice because I know about you, but it's also nice to see you do what you do. And I've seen you do what you do, or a lot, or some of what you do, right? And it's great. You know, there was a conversation we had last week with Neil Phillips. Neil Phillips runs what's called Visible Men and the Visible Men Academy down in Florida, which is a charter school primarily focused on boys of color. And race has kind of been his thing forever. And he talked about, you know, this question of inclusion. And we had an interesting conversation about who's the includer in this case, right? Like, what does that mean? And we talked about, and so like a little bit of considering what does that term mean? And what are the implications of what it means? And then the other one we talked about was tolerance, because there's something about tolerance which feels insufficient. There's almost like a negative tenor to it or something. Now, I want to say, importantly, that, you know, we are three white people here. Two of us are men, one of us is a woman. And so our point of view is limited, right? I want to believe our curiosity is high, and I want to believe our openness is high, right, at the same time. And my guess is it could be higher for both, right? I just think, like, history would suggest that I can say that, but what's actually happening sort of in my soul? And Jocelyn, you're the CEO of Him for Her. You know, importantly, what you've done is you've looked at ways to get women, but I think critically, because again, I've seen you in action, it's really women and people of color critically involved in board leadership throughout the country. And generally, just to give you a sense, we're talking about big companies, right? Is that fair? I mean, I'm guessing you do smaller ones too, but big companies are certainly on the list, right?
Yes. We do all sizes of companies and stages of companies, from seed all the way to public. Correct.
Yeah. And so, Jocelyn, among the reasons I thought it would be interesting to have you here today, and I do want to start because I want to do a quick check-in on COVID. So we'll do a quick COVID check-in. It's something that I think is valuable, and it has a lot to do with where this show came from. But I think the other thing that I think is powerful is, you know, your perspective, not only as a participant, and I'm going to say an activist of a kind in making corporations healthier in America, but also an observer generally, right? Just a general observer. You know, I do speak ideally, but I also speak hopefully ideally, because I believe that these things are possible, you know, and if you just consider, you know, shareholder value as the focus of what historically have been public corporations or corporations generally in America is, I don't think it's good enough for me personally. I know I'm speaking ideally. Again, it's like anyone can point a finger, but I really do think it's possible for us to rethink that and benefit corporations. The notion of a B Corp has already taken strides towards that. I think we could go even further. I think we're on our way there, but I might be a little too hopeful. And, you know, RP and I had a conversation a few weeks ago where he knew I kind of got upset because I was sort of, this is pre-George Floyd, but it was sort of, you know, just before. And I was sort of lamenting, you know, that this sense of, can we take the good of COVID into the next phase? And a prominent CEO basically said, not us. That's too strong. He didn't say it like that, but he said a version of that. And I got sad. I got bummed, and I felt like, oh, that stinks. I don't think, by the way, he speaks for everybody, but it was just sort of a moment that took me aback. I bet if I asked him that today, RP, he'd give a different answer.
I don't think he would.
You don't think he would?
No, I think his view was, we've got an amazing business. We don't need to change much. And he would lean back on how he thought they were a mentorship business, so they have to be near each other.
Yeah, but I just wonder if he might not inject more humanity today based on what's happened in the last 2 weeks. I don't know. That's total speculation on my part. That's probably unfair. So Jocelyn, to me, that's the conversation. Then anything else that you want to sort of bring into that, or anything outside of that too. But Pivot Quickly RP, I feel like I saw more intense headlines since we spoke yesterday, and it does seem to be the case that COVID is finding its way to higher numbers increasingly. And while maybe that's not surprising, when you see the reality of it, it feels a little bit daunting.
Well, I mean, we've been hoping, everyone's been hoping that the summer would be a slow season for the disease. There's a lot of physical, biological reasons to think that could be the case. We've discussed them before about distance and about being outside and the sun and et cetera. And we've also noted, and we've predicted this, that this, and I think most people have, that we'd see an uptick in cases across the country. We said yesterday that 20 cases have seen an uptick in cases. Today it's 21 cases. 21 states have seen upticks in cases. And now the thing to remember is these aren't yet New York City full-blown panic, hospitals getting overwhelmed increases. These are orders of, you know, you're still in the hundreds of new cases per, hundreds of new potential fatalities actually per state. That's a very bad thing when you multiply it and add it up. But, and it's growing. So the summer has not destroyed the virus. No one thought it would. Cases are growing. We don't yet know if the protests have increased viral spread. They almost certainly will. But again, I'm hoping it won't be a panic number. And so again, look, if you're outside and the wind is blowing and the sun is shining and you're not singing to each other, literally singing, or getting right into those faces for a prolonged period of time, the science says transmission is harder, not zero, harder. If you're inside, like Arizona, you recall, why is Arizona having an uptick? It's 106 degrees down there because people are inside in the air conditioning. So we'll see. And let's hope that the numbers stay low. And all this growth, which we are seeing now, does predict that the fall would be worse.
Yeah. Jocelyn, when you see inside companies right now, and I'm sure it's been a challenging time within big companies or companies generally, where do you see the concern and the focus on COVID over the last few weeks and up to now?
Yeah, so it's been an interesting conversation, and I'd say it kind of falls along a couple of different lines. One is the focus on the individual, right? We've had a lot of conversations in the past about this department, this city, that city, and a lot of those previous assumptions are broken down because now it's about the individual, which causes kind of another trend, which is understanding the individual, which means asking, how are you doing? So this kind of increased focus on mental health of the individual. I think a lot of companies are thinking really broadly about going back to work. I've heard 100% remote. I've heard, we don't know, but it's no time soon. I've heard stories of, we're gonna take the real estate savings and not take it to the bottom line, but pour it into our people. There's a lot of conversation about culture, right? Because a lot of these companies have very deep cultures that they've spent years cultivating, but they've done it with mechanisms that require you to be in the office, which may have benefited those people who've been at the company, you know, 2, 3, 5 years, but what happens if I hired you yesterday? And so really rethinking, like, the kind of new hire onboarding process is something that's uncharted waters.
Yeah. And would you say that since, and I don't know, I mean, this is all real time stuff, but, like, you know, the additional impact of the George Floyd moment, I imagine that creates a new layer of, you know, both concern and hope, but then also, but complication at a minimum. Would you say that's true?
That's definitely true. In fact, our virtual conversations, we kicked off, you know, like everybody, just a few weeks ago, and really focused on two topics, which were new norms and issues of equality. This was in the lens of the disease itself. And so, coupled with the events of the last 2 weeks, those conversations are getting harder and deeper for leaders to figure out. I think almost every CEO is struggling on what to do, how to do it, and how to do it correctly. And there's an element too of doing and listening and the balance of the two, giving people space, which kind of, in some ways, because some of these companies were already attuned to this idea of listening and asking how you are, maybe set them up a little bit better for the moment of needing to ask it again and in a deeper way and in a different way.
Yeah. You know, I just want to point out, you know, I'm guessing many of you have heard this before. There was a time when if you went through any city in the world, the biggest building in town was a church. It then became that the biggest building in any town was the Capitol. And now the biggest building in any town is a business. It's a corporation, typically the case. And so I think one of the reasons that this becomes so vital is if you start to consider culture. Corporations and businesses have such a huge impact on culture that, you know, one among the reasons, because there are many, that this these questions become so critical is because, you know, RP, we've talked a lot about it's time for people to be leaders. Corporate leadership, you may not, you know, you may be somebody who's against corporations. You might be somebody who thinks, you know, they're the undoing. That whatever your view may be. There's a reality here too, though, which is that the amount of time and the amount of impact that corporations have on our culture is massive. And so regardless of your opinion on sort of the weakness, strength, existence, non-existence of corporations generally, certainly as a cultural impact item, it's huge and vital. And so I don't think it's crazy to consider that some of the problems that we've run into around race and around other things, the role that corporations can play is really big, and really it could be very helpful. And you know, my view, that's where I go, and I understand it probably has been restrictive and unhelpful in many ways historically. But I don't know if you want to add to that, but I, you know, when people think about like, why does this matter? Well, it matters for good reason.
Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of hope. I think I share with you probably maybe a lot of optimism just as a human. I'm a very optimistic person, but I think what I'm optimistic about, and I was sharing this with someone on the phone this morning, is we haven't had a hard time getting male allies to say yes to help us with the cause of diversity in the boardroom. And I think that's hopeful, because if we give people tools and mechanisms for change and they say yes to those tools and mechanisms for change, then change can happen. I think one of the things that you guys have talked about in some of your prior shows is the short-term attention span. And that, I think, needs attention because, and Brad Feld, who's one of our supporters, had a wonderful quote this week. I can read it if you want, but the spirit of it was, I hope the leaders are listening, talking, and doing, but with a long-term lens. Because when you're trying to address systemic change, you need focus, but you need it for a duration of time, and you need it to evolve with time, right? So we asked these two questions 7 weeks ago, and they have a different meaning 2 weeks ago. Doesn't mean we shouldn't ask the same questions 4 weeks from now.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that was powerful, RP, I was in the meeting with Jocelyn, and they were describing board makeup. And, you know, among the topics discussed was sort of this hero CEO types or star business people. And there were two women from among the most prominent banks in America who... I'm only noting that they were women because I think that's part of what you do well, but also it was interesting to hear their perspective. They were both in equities, and they both said, it makes no difference to us when you put these stars on your board. And they had the data to back it up, that, you know, the corporate leadership on the board level, there's this impression that I need that badass person, often a man, to make you think the value of my company is high. That was really potent to me. And then the other thing I think about in a related way is, you know, you start to consider like brand values and things, right? Like there are brands, Nike, Apple, the brands themselves are worth so much, and it shows on the in the price of the stock. Well, so too can positive cultural impact, right? And so all of those things, when you start to think about how companies are valued, and to be fair, any corporate CEO, the value of their company is going to be strongly in the mix of their own view of their own success. I don't think there's necessarily anything necessarily wrong with that, but I think it's a, I found that really interesting and exciting in a way. And I thought, well, we got to get the word out on that. Well, first of all, do you have anything you want to say about that? I mean, am I accurate in what I heard?
You're accurate in what you heard. And I also think one of the things, you know, we've asked a lot in our current conversations about what's changing about boards in this moment. And a lot of what I'm hearing back is, you know, what people often forget is it is a job. I mean, there is a fiscal duty, there's a responsibility. And in a case where you have companies whose revenue was stripped overnight, industries that were wiped overnight, the boards are getting put to work and work in ways that really were unpredictable and where, you know, have you seen around this corner? Not many people have. So that being a requirement, not to say that doesn't go away, but wow, does it open the doors for new requirements of what companies actually need right now when they do need a spirit of entrepreneurship, because they may have to pivot. All that three-year strategy you presented in Q4 of last year, guess what? Maybe it just got ripped up overnight. And so the skills required to guide the CEO, which I have an 8 and 9-year-old, and they ask, what does a board member do? And I had to describe it in their terms. I said, it's the boss of the boss, right? So the skills to guide that CEO are evolving, which is hopeful, I believe, because it opens the door for diverse experience, diverse age, diverse background. People needing to represent the customer they build the products for, right? That's an important lens to have in the boardroom.
Jocelyn, when you think about...
Go ahead.
Sorry,
please.
Go, RP.
No, Tom, please go.
Well, I was just going to ask you, like, as Jocelyn speaks, are you reflecting in part on your own government experience and how that relates to leadership within the government?
Not as much as I'm reflecting my private sector experience. I've been on a bunch of boards, public and private. You know, I run a few companies that have advisory boards. I've been on companies that have had, you know, actual boards where I've been, in the C-suite and had to deal with the boards or ideally get benefit from the boards. And I, Jocelyn, you're making a point that's kind of fascinating. If I hear you correctly, you know, can we find a note of optimism as we redefine boards, as we redefine corporations? So Corona will help us redefine some corporate goals. The George Floyd protests and George Floyd realities will help us redefine what it means to be a corporation. Ideally, we're all hoping, I think, that corporations move to put people over profits and not profits over people, a broad process. It is a huge process. All of us have been working on it to some extent for decades. I mean, I remember having conversations with corporations about this 25 years ago, about how it could be in their profitable interest to put people first. And you have to then, and probably now, frame all this in the framework, particularly for public companies, as to shareholder value. But as those things are changing, Jocelyn, do I hear you saying that makes more not only room, but it makes a demand that you have a different kind of board? That maybe what we call diversity becomes more valuable to the company as you make a great point about having to pivot, be entrepreneurial. That's a skill set that perhaps you'll find in a more diverse candidate. You need to be more aware of who your customers are. And generally, as corporations ideally are going to, you know, win or lose based on showing their soul, maybe that helps change the board composition.
Yes. Yes. I mean, there are, you know, we had a conversation the other day where a lot of people came from the financial industry, right? This is an industry where moving slow hasn't really hurt from a technological standpoint. And overnight now they need to move faster. They need more, you know, quote unquote, digital transformation than ever. And you look at the people on the board and you ask yourself, do we have that skill set, right? It's a competency matrix. Every board is its own ecosystem. It's made up of a CEO, and no CEO looks like the next CEO. It's made up of the sitting board members who all bring to the table a different set of experiences. And so most of the boards who want to do well will look around the table and ask, what do we need for our strategy and what's missing? And I think the strategy piece is what's really changed in the last, call it 10 or so weeks, because industries have been disrupted by something that no one really could have predicted. I mean, RPU predicted it, but you know what I mean.
Well, that's a fascinating, you know, that's a little off topic, but worth, I would love to get your view on this. you know, for years and years, we've been working with corporations at Ergo and said, you know, saying to them, you need to be aware of this risk or that risk. And sometimes it's pandemics and sometimes it's war and sometimes it's whatever. And the basic answer has been, oh, okay, you know, sure. You know, that tail risk thing, we don't think that much about it, but there's a person who works here and you can go talk to them. And, you know, the corporations haven't really taken tail risk very seriously. A few have, they become the notable exceptions. And I think we'd all like to believe, as much as we'd like to believe, that there's a removing of the scales from the eyes moment here where corporations think of people over profits. I'd also like to think that corporations now are willing to invest just a little bit more in risk preparedness, just a little bit more in, you know, the tail risk possibilities. But I, and similar to the comment Tom was making earlier about the very serious CEO who we spoke with recently, who said, you know, I'm not going to really change the way we do business. I do have a pessimistic view that we're just going to get back to business as normal. People are just going to get back to what things were like before, because it kind of worked, you know, until things didn't. And I, you know, that concrete change and how it happens, that's sort of what your life is, right? You're trying to get these businesses to change in a very concrete way. How do you think of the time horizon to do that?
Well, I think of the time horizon for systemic change to be a long one, even though the methodology we came up with is all about getting something done now. So I think about it both short-term and long-term, because it's a system we're trying to change. So systems take longer to change. What you said about, you know, will companies take these risks more seriously? I think what we're going to see play out is there's a lot of industries that were okay, or they won in this scenario, and there are many that lost. And it was, you know, industry-wide and somewhat unfair, right? In which industries were hurt the most. I don't think those people have the luxury of going back to things the way they were. And I think because of the individual being impacted the way the individual is impacted, the leader might say things will go back to the way they are. But what happens to the single mom with no childcare? What happens to, you know, school doesn't start in my state? Or, you know, I am caring for a parent that has diabetes. So I actually think there's a bigger trend that will prevent us from getting back to what you said, like it's the same. And then from a business strategy point of view, some industries can't. Like they literally can't go back to what it was. I mean, I'm deep in the restaurant industry. They can't go back to what it was overnight. So there, it doesn't matter who the leader is. The pandemic has caused a reality.
That's a great point. I mean, there are, I like the concept of, you know, you have to have employees obviously to make most of these businesses function. And so many employees' lives are going to be so deeply impacted, let's say until there's a vaccine, that the businesses are going to have to pivot to be able to do that. And most of the pivots I'm thinking of, work from home, more flexible hours, understanding the demand, the family and personal demands on employees, all those, those at least, trend towards positive in our equation of people over profits. I wonder if there are things that are going to make, that are going to be, you know, unintended consequences that are going to make businesses, you know, more aggressive in this instance, because they're under economic pressure there by this. You know, I guess one example I'm just thinking off the top of my head is you work a lot in restaurants. Restaurants are obviously crushed by this. You know, we know that restaurants operate, a really great restaurant has a 15% profit margin. That's an extraordinary success. And if all of a sudden you're only allowed to have half as many people sitting in your restaurant, that margin's gone. And restaurants, a lot of restaurants, hundreds of thousands of them are family-owned small businesses that are going to be in big trouble. So that's going to be a regressive impact on, in some extent, too.
Yeah, and I actually even think we might be too premature in assuming that the work from home is a positive. You know, there's all sorts of things that happen in a home that aren't positive. There's all sorts of people who don't have private space, have roommates, don't have great Wi-Fi, don't want people looking in their kitchen. Their mental health is driven by interaction with their team members. One thing that came up yesterday is there a new inequality that might happen where the people who get to go to the office get the benefit? We, at Him for Her, we say we engineer serendipity. But there is some serendipity in business. There's a lot of serendipity in business. Like if I ask the two of you, how did you get your board seat? Or how did, I bet I'd hear a personal network story, serendipity. And so what happens to those people who can't get back to the office because of their family situation and those that can, is that a new inequality that we are yet to face is a question.
Stacy Woodland educated at least me to something about that. So Jocelyn, like, I couldn't agree with that more. It's not a reality that I live, so I have to learn it. And Stacy Woodland, who's the head of the YWCA in the middle of Pennsylvania, an extraordinary leader. I'm sure you saw the show with her. If you didn't, I think you'd love it. Stacy mentioned that some of her employees, you know, being at home is not a safe space, abusive home environments, etc. So that's a fantastic point.
Say, Jocelyn, if I have one of the things RP and I have been talking about lately, and I'm going to keep asking this question and pushing this as much for me, maybe, as what I believe. I really don't want to go back. I don't want to go back to certain practices that we had pre-COVID. And in particular, and they're very related, I don't want us to not take advantage in the best of ways. A very difficult and negative situation, which is George Floyd. Now, the question is, I mean, the bad news is there's another headline coming. It's right out there. I don't know what it is, but it's coming. It's right over there somewhere, and it's going to dominate soon. And within our busy lives, with so much information coming our way, it bums me out to think about another headline missing an opportunity to make a better culture. And so, you know, this is just my point of view. I'm all for a better government. I'm all for it. I'm just not sure that's where you're going to find the answer, or not the whole answer. Do you share that fear? And do you have any thoughts on how I might think about all of us doing something to prevent that from happening, which is just to say momentum steals the day and momentum is being busy and making money?
Yeah, so I share that. I don't focus on government. Bless RP for being in that space. I focus on for-profit businesses. And I agree with what you said, which is whether or not you believe in for-profit business, whether or not you think you live under the guidance of it, you do. You know, you're either living under the decisions of in rooms in government or in rooms of business, which is why we focus a lot on the rooms in business. And one interesting thing about the Times is that while there's multiple headlines, they're intertwined, right? As I said, we already had a question on equality issues caused by the pandemic. But the truth is the time we're living under is revealing cracks that were already in the system. How do we keep ourselves from forgetting the cracks are there? I think it does start at the top, right? I do believe in that as well. And someone sent a quote to me in the last week was, you know, the two things you can do are write checks or put people who can be there in the rooms where decisions get made. Write checks, put people in the rooms where decisions get made. Those two things we can do. There are people who can write checks, whether that's to entrepreneurs who have previously never been funded. There are funds that have emerged. You know, Goldman has a fund, SoftBank has a fund specifically to do just that. Putting people in rooms where decisions get made that represent their consumer, that represent their employee base. You know, we've had a CEO stand up at our dinner and say, I'm super proud of our executive team. I'm super proud of our employee base. I'm super proud of our customer base. I'm embarrassed to show them a picture of my board, right? So there is hope that if you put some of these things in the system, whatever headline's hitting, the voice will be heard. The funding will be there to get the product into market that solves the problem that isn't getting solved. And that's what I believe.
Jocelyn, you know, if I can ask you a question, One thing I spent a little bit of time looking at professionally for a number of years is cybersecurity. And it's a situation where a number of folks have warned CEOs over the years that you should spend more money on cybersecurity or you're going to pay a big cost at the end. And it didn't happen until Sony was hacked and all their machines were bricked, all their phones were bricked. And a lot of people in the business world woke up to, wow, like cybersecurity is a thing. That story, that potential fear, embarrassment, cost to the CEOs, the story they could relate to, began to move them to action. You were talking before about like the superstar, actually, I guess Tom was talking about the superstar board. Look at all the good and the great we have in our board. Historically, often that meant white men. And I think of a story, and it might be somewhat of a conflict of a challenge because it's a female CEO, but I think of Theranos, where they had this white man, good and the great board. And of course, Theranos turned out to be a fraud. And I wonder if stories like that will motivate people to, you know, change the way they think about boards. Much like, look, George Floyd is a man who died in a slow motion murder, and it became a story that all of us watched and we were able to ingrain. And we don't learn through stats, we learn through stories. Is something like the Theranos story powerful for you to say, look, you need a diverse board that's actually engaged? I mean, the CEO was a woman, obviously, but is that a good story? Are there other stories you
use? Yeah, it is, and it's a story that's come up. So, you know, we've done 36 dinners in 12 cities, including London. So we've had dinner with hundreds of board members, CEOs, and executives, and that story has come up multiple times. It also, I wouldn't say it was that specifically, but one of the questions, one of the two questions we asked at all of our dinners is, how does the board stay in touch with what's really going on at a company, right? That just that question, how does a board stay in touch with what's really going on at the company? And so I'm in full agreement with you that we learn through stories, and that's why we have off the record dinners, because people come and tell stories. And so we're sitting there, and Tom, that's what you were at, where people told story after story after story. And we hear the good, and then we also hear the failures of when the board didn't know what was going on in a company. And we also talk about what makes a valuable board member. And one of the qualities that bubbles up every single time is time. The board member that has the time and the board member that spends the time. And so one of the challenges, Tom, I think of the kind of superstar definition is those people maybe, because of their scenario, also don't have the time. If they had the time, they might actually be an amazing board member. But if they're spread too thin and they're in a press release and not in the building, and in the building is in quotes, especially these days, how valuable are they going to be?
It's a whole different dynamic, right? Sarbanes-Oxley makes board members of public companies individually liable for misdeeds in the company. So they better be engaged. They better be involved. That was supposed to create, and that should have created perhaps to some extent more diversity in the board because of your point about time. I you know, my experience, that rings absolutely true. There are superstar board members who not only have the time, but they also, you know, they feel a real shareholder responsibility, and they get in the face of the executive team regularly and ask hard questions.
Yeah, I mean, it was Danny that says, you know, the board members at Shake Shack, like, they go and work the kitchen right before they start. I sit on a private board, and my onboarding was I sat in new hire training with all the other employees, right? So there's so many ways, and those are just two small examples, so many ways to stay close to what's really going on in the company, and creative ways that leaders are figuring it out. But I mean, if you think about the Theranos board, that would be the question I'd want to hear from them, is how did they know what was really going on, right?
Yeah, and then the narrative of the stories is they didn't at all, they didn't care, and they just listened to her. You know, I don't know if this is a bridge too far, but a lot of what we've talked about in, for example, the defund police movement, cop being a citizen on patrol, is the idea that, you know, we as citizens need to make sure that our government is responsive to us. And similarly, a board nominally is making sure the business is responsive to the shareholders. It's a similar loop, right? It's ensuring responsibility from these large, powerful organizations generally, and ensuring that they are really being responsible, you know, to the atomized individual. Is it the citizen? Is it the shareholder? And of course, in large corporations, there's no such thing as just a shareholder anymore. They really have a global role that they have to live up to. You know, I'm sure you've done it, but if you look at the actual economic impact of large corporations versus many companies, many countries, you know, the 5 or 10 largest corporations in the world are economically more powerful than the 150 smallest countries in the world. You know, they are clearly supra states themselves. So there's no such thing anymore of just making sure their shareholders are being listened to. They really have a global responsibility. It's kind of profound. The rise of the mega corporations is a pretty new thing.
It is. And I would say the other interesting thing is, you know, the Business Roundtable news last year of saying it's not just about the shareholder, it's about the stakeholder. You know, steps like that, Goldman saying we won't take a company public unless they have a diverse board. They didn't just speak on gender, by the way. And this was at Davos, so this was early this year. That was a major thing. And yes, we have all these megacorps, but you know, we work with both public and private companies. And I think what people forget is how many private companies there are and how, you know, while those public companies are massive in their economic value, from a numbers game, there aren't as many of those as there are the private companies. And the private companies are actually building the products and services of our future. They are going to become the future public companies. And so they're equally important and also further behind in their diversity. So everyone needs work and everyone needs help. But part of why we talk about public companies so much is because the data is public. It's easy to find, it's easy to track, and it's easy to measure. Private companies are vastly important, and they're just a little bit under the radar because the numbers aren't out in the public sphere as much.
When you think about orders of benefit, right? I think there's this impression, which by the way, it's a good reason, is that there's a feel-good aspect to this. I would argue there is. I think that's fine. What do you view? Like, what's at the top of the totem pole of the value that this would that this creates? This being boards that are more representative of the world at large.
I mean, our vision is that we will transform lives by unlocking the social and the economic benefit of a diverse boardroom. And I'll give you just one little story, because we learn by stories and not vision statements. We helped a woman who's amazingly talented get visibility that landed her the board seat. She is the first woman on this board. The first thing they asked her to do as the board member was to look at the D&I program for the company, employee benefit. She also happens to be the mother of a biracial child, which wouldn't be evident from anything unless you heard her story. And so now she's helping that company through their approach to all the work that they need to do around race and ethnicity and underrepresented groups and intersections. So that's just one story. Now, we could follow that through and see how much value gets created at that company. There's many studies out there that do show there's economic benefit to a diverse board. There's, you know, countless now. There's studies out there that say that recalls of drugs are fewer when there's a diverse board. So there's a lot of academic studies that prove that there's economic benefit. But I truly believe in our vision statement, and I watch it happen. I watch it happen every time we hear from a woman who's on a board who enacts a change that will benefit the employee base, that will benefit the customers that they go on to serve, the potentially the vendors they sign up. I mean, we've had a CEO who's very amazing in this space that said he won't take a speaking gig again when he looks out into the audience and doesn't see his customer base.
You know, so the night that I was there, Jocelyn, because I'm going to do my best from memory, but the crowd was quite diverse. We were all 30 or older, so I guess that's okay in business, right? But that was the one missing ingredient, which, by the way, I'm not suggesting you have children there. And the conversation, to be clear, was in some part about what you're describing. And then in broader part or larger part, it was about what is a board and how does a board function well? And one of my takeaways, and by the way, there were CEOs there from some of the biggest corporations in the world and board members from some of the biggest corporations in the world. I'd never had that. I never sat in a room where we speak openly about this and ask ourselves these questions and train and try to be better. You know, and I've been on a board for 35 years, you know, for many, many years, and never had that experience. So one, I would just point that out. I mean, maybe there are good board practice programs that I'm unaware of that somehow I missed out on. That's one side of it. The other side of it I want to comment on is I was actually quite impressed with the seemingly enthusiastic openness of everybody there. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, and I would say, you know, like many companies, and I know you've talked about your own, you know, 10 weeks ago, we've based our serendipity on in-person dinners. What happens when you can't do that? Well, we've launched virtual conversations, and what we didn't realize is how much that would unlock. One, to be having conversations during such a pivotal time when people are being very vulnerable. And we had one last week. Our host was a female woman of color CEO who said she canceled everything last week except our conversation because these are so important right now. And so what I'm finding is that if you bring people together who share a sense of purpose around leadership, and you allow people to be human and off the record and not recorded, they will share stories and people will learn and they'll remember. And you're right. What's great about it is we're bringing people together they didn't otherwise know. We haven't really reinvented anything. People have always done great things by breaking bread together at a table. We just invited different guests. It's not, you know, it's profound and simple. We just opened the aperture.
If there's just two thoughts I wanted to make sure I mentioned before we say goodbye, Jocelyn. One, and I'd love your thoughts on, one is if there's a couple of countries, New Zealand, Germany, and South Korea, that have done profoundly better than most other countries in the corona response, and New Zealand and Germany are both led by women. South Korea has got a man as prime minister, but a woman led their corona response. And there was a great New York Times article a couple weeks ago you might have seen that correlated this to female leadership and as to why that might be the case, different aspects of leaders who are female versus males. I thought it was fascinating. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I do. And I believe that what I believe in, you know, is that diversity is well beyond single lens. And there is a word for this, right? The intersection of different qualities that make you who you are. Tom, you know, you can name five different things of who is Tom, RP, what are five different things of RP? And then you could overlay those and see which ones are similar, right? You know, I'm guessing, but you probably both associate with male. You both look to me to be white. The thing about having women is it's a new lens. It's a different voice. It's a different perspective. You know, but I had a woman report back to me today, three different, I'm a woman, I'm black, and I'm gay. She said those things to me. She relates to those three things. And I believe she's walked a different life on this planet because of those things. And so when she's brought into a room to make a decision about something, she's going to consider, literally her brain's just going to consider an element that maybe the two of you wouldn't consider. It does not make you bad people, not smart people, or not well-intentioned people, but you have to believe that there will be a better conversation and that therefore there will be a better decision and therefore there will be a better outcome. And, you know, I was trained in this a little bit through the fellowship out of Aspen that where this venture was born, where they bring 22 fellows together and they go deep on making sure there's, you know, we joke, there's a spreadsheet with 30 columns of diversity, but you know, there probably are 30 columns to each of us. And if we're only talking about one column, if we're only seeing one column, and that's true right now. Look at the boardrooms, look at the government. It looks like a pretty similar population of people. And then you ask yourself, how can we be making the best decisions if that's true?
Just two quick thoughts. One is, we know we did a lot of study on this idea about how decision makers often miss warnings of catastrophes. So a Cassandra comes forward and says, yes. Here's my...
I was nodding during that whole segment. I was like in my car listening, just nodding and nodding and nodding.
Yeah, it's biases and heuristics that prevent us from including these points of view, and then, you know, catastrophe strikes. And a number of our Cassandras were women, and that's perhaps part of why their voice didn't come up to the point where it needed to be heard. Just shifting the topic slightly, you talk a lot about, I think this great point about not just responding to shareholders, but to stakeholders. A key stakeholder, obviously, is employees. One thing that I'm excited for us to dive into a little further, maybe not in this conversation, is CEOs reaching out to local jurisdictions. Policing happens at the locality, reaching out to police departments, police chiefs, DAs, and mayors, and saying, look, because my stakeholders are employees in your towns, I have a series of questions I want to address with you. I think it could be a powerful movement, and I like that. I like your focus on stakeholders, not just shareholders. And there's one example of how to manifest that, make it concrete.
Yeah, that's an incredible idea. Well, I do know our reopening committee, I know two CEOs on it. So, you know, in California, there's a lot of business leaders. I don't sit on the committee. I can't report what happens there, but I was really happy to at least hear the fabric.
Jocelyn, I know I got to be sensitive to both of your guys' time right now. We should break it up. But I do want to say, you know, one, I'm hopeful. I want to just stress that the work that you do is exciting. People should be excited about this. Excited because there's just a world out there that you might not imagine possible. And there are warriors. I hope I can call you a warrior. Some people don't like that word.
I'll take it. You know, it's Thursday and I'll be a warrior today. Thank you, Tom.
Well, you know, people use the term in yoga because I use it a lot and my team's like, oh, that's a harsh word. I'm like, and I use it in yoga class. Like,
yeah, you know. I do a lot of yoga. So I'm
okay. So you're familiar with the term, but I think what it states is that, you know, often as a warrior, you have a plan and you're going to go places, but it's actually your posture that gets it accomplished because you don't know what's going to happen in the next, you don't always know what's going to happen. But I feel like, you know, people should root for you. This is my opinion. And I think the best way to do it is understand what she's talking about. Because it may, you know, it depends on who you are. I mean, some people, of course, right? But others might be like, well, does it matter? And is this? Well, I think if you really pay attention, you start to look at it and you see this world that's emerging, there's something about this that is not only very beneficial, but also very hopeful. Because you don't know how many other things this could lead to in today's world. So,
Tom, I will say, and this will be my last word because I want to respect your time, is just there is hope in the work that we do. My inbox has a lot of gratitude. And essentially, we're just shining a flashlight to the talent that's already there. It's already there. It just needs to get seen and put in the rooms where decisions get made. And when we watch that happen, it's like, you know, a genie's let out of the bottle. It's a great feeling. And so the more support that we get in this visibility work, the more we're going to empower the people who spent their lives earning the places that we want to eventually see them in. So thank you for having me today. I really enjoyed the conversation.
It's great
to make. By the way, and that's a fact, what you just said. I'm glad you said that. It's already there.
It's already there.
You're not on like some search with a magnifying glass. Like, it's there.
I mean, I was on a call this morning, chills, when I heard this woman's story. That happens every single day. I could tell you a story every single day about a talented person who's not yet on a board.
Yeah.
And I think we have example after example of where inclusion and having a diversity of opinions really can actually not only make a better organization, but can make a safer world. You know, if you look at some of the catastrophes that have hit us, the reason they were ignored, the warnings, the absolutely appropriate and accurate warnings were ignored because the person giving the warning was different than the person who was listening. It was they were unable to get past their biases and listen to the warning that if they had heeded, you know, perhaps that catastrophe wouldn't have struck us and cost often thousands of lives and millions or billions of dollars. So there's real reason to increase our diversity.
Thank you for your time, Jocelyn.
And thank you, RP, guys.
Nice to meet you, Jocelyn. Thanks so much.